to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau faces a Supreme Court challenge to its independence from the president. We'll find out what the agency does and what's at stake in the nation's highest court. Now,
we on Earth have just awakened to the great oceans of space and time from which we have emerged.
That's the voice of the late Carl Sagan at the end of the very first episode of the 1980s show, Cosmos. The series was beloved in its time, and luckily for fans, it hasn't gone away, thanks in large part to our next guest. Ann Drian was a co-writer of the original Cosmos, and she's the brains behind the latest incarnation, which begins its third season next Monday on the National Geographic Channel. The latest season and the show's companion book, written by Ann Drian, are called Cosmos, Possible Worlds. Ann, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, I'm so excited to be with you and your listeners.
Can you talk about the mission of Cosmos, the power of storytelling in helping us understand science and the universe we live in?
Well, if I can distill the mission of Cosmos into one idea, it's that the revelations of the grandeur and the beauty of the universe and nature that modern science has given us really belong to everyone, to each of us. It's a birthright. And for a long time, there's been a great tall wall around science that has intimidated the rest of us. And it's the dream of Cosmos that every viewer, every reader of our books will come away uplifted and empowered by this information and be informed decision makers in a society that aspires to become a democracy.
You tell in the show and in the book, not just the story of the science, but of the scientists, the people who made things happen over the decades, over the centuries. Why is that an important part of the story?
Well, because I think we all feel the long shadow over our future. Many of us, I know I do, feel powerless. And yet, everyone alive, everyone who can hear my voice at this moment, is descended from generations of our ancestors who had their backs against the wall time and time again. And they rallied. They rose to the challenge. And now we are the link in this long chain of life that stretches back 4 billion years on our planet. It's up to us to awaken from our sleepwalking and to act in defense not only of our civilization, but also of the other species with whom we share this planet.
You open the book at the 1939 World Fair in New York and a young Carl Sagan. Can you talk about that as a source of inspiration for him?
Yes. I have imagined countless times the 5-year-old Carl Sagan. His parents live paycheck to paycheck in a small apartment. And they don't. None of them have ever even met a scientist. And yet they go to that 1939 New York World's Fair. And they're so poor, they have to bring a brown bag lunch. They can't afford any of the souvenirs that Carl desperately wants. And yet at that moment, Carl discovers that there's such a thing as the future, and that the only way to get to it is through science. And so on that day, his life trajectory was formed. And I think it's a reason for hope, first of all, in terms of the improbable circumstances that he came from, but also because, you know, the New York World's Fair was opened by Albert Einstein. And he said this great thing. He said, if science is ever to fully fulfill its mission, the way that art has done, its inner meaning must penetrate to the consciousness of the people. And that's the dream of Cosmos. There's no idea in science that cannot be explained with clarity and simplicity. And Carl was, of course, an artist at doing so. And by doing that, he connected with people in every country on Earth. So many scientists, so many doctors, so many teachers, engineers were first engaged in the scientific enterprise by seeing cosmos. And so what we hope at this time when science is under attack, when some of our leaders speak of science with such contempt, in a fear-based environment, we need a reality-based way of seeing things. And that's what I think science offers.
Talking to Ann Driehan, co-creator with the late Carl Sagan, her late husband, of the original Cosmos series. She's the creator of the newest incarnation, Cosmos Possible Worlds, and the author of a book of the same name. And that thread continues. You share a personal story in your book of a doctor inspired by Carl Sagan. And yes. You and your son had a very great need for this doctor. Can you share that with us?
Yes. During the making of this season, Sam Sagan, my son, who is a co-producer, contributed many of the ideas that Brandon Braga and I, that became the scripts that we wrote. And we were working together in the editing room. And suddenly Sam, 27 years old, stood up and said, "I have a splitting headache." And then instantly some maternal instinct kicked in. And I said, "I'm taking you to the hospital." And everyone in the room looked at me like I was nuts. But we rushed to Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, and within minutes they had determined that he was having a massive cerebral hemorrhage. And so we waited, and there were some really horrible first days, and then we were told that there was one doctor who could fix this problem. And I met with him, and he was very formal and detached at first, and he told me that Sam's odds were terrible. And that there was a procedure that he could do. It was very delicate, but that he wanted to warn me that Sam would most likely be severely impaired if he survived. So I said, "Well, we have to ask Sam." And we walked into Sam's ICU room. And the doctor asked Sam, "Well, what do you do for a living?" And Sam said, "Well, I actually work with my mom." He said, "What do you do?" He said, "Well, we work on a television series, Cosmos." And the doctor, his whole demeanor changed radically. And he looked at us and he said, "If you come of age in a poor country like Colombia, as I did, and Carl Sagan calls you to science, the only avenue open to you is medicine. And that's why I'm standing here right this moment." And I knew when he said that he would do everything to save Sam, and he did. And I'm so fortunate to be able to tell you that not only did Sam survive, but he survived completely intact and only changed by an enhanced love of the preciousness of life.
I'm so glad it worked out that way. And it reminds me the coincidence of our existence that's come about, all these, stars through the universe ending up as us. That's a thing I don't know, I took away from the original Cosmos, how amazing it is that we're here and we can have that kind of serendipity in our lives.
That's my favorite line in all of Cosmos, is we are a way for the universe to know itself. We are star stuff. That's one of the great insights that Carl Sagan and other scientists first tumbled to in the 20th century. And it still gives me goosebumps to think that my hair, my bones, my skin, every atom in my being and yours was forged in the fiery hearts of distant stars. So the cosmos is within us.
We're talking to Ann Driehan, acclaimed science communicator, creator of the TV series Cosmos. The newest season, Possible Worlds, airs Monday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you watched Cosmos over the years, maybe with your kids, maybe as a kid yourself? What have you thought about it? Has it helped you learn new things about science and humanity? Did it shape your career at all? Do you have questions about the making of the show, the creation of the show? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk with acclaimed science communicator Ann Driehan about her new book, Cosmos Possible Worlds, and the newest season of the TV show by the same name. It airs starting on Monday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the Cosmos TV show, past or present? Has the show opened up an interest in science or space for you or maybe your children? Do you have questions about the show? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And I want to ask about what may have been a difficult moment behind the scenes. Neil deGrasse Tyson hosting the show. Listeners may remember he had been accused publicly of behaving inappropriately and making sexual innuendos to a Cosmos producer. Other incidents of accusations of creepy behavior. Also one accusation of rape. There was an investigation by networks. What do you think about the process and the outcome with Neil deGrasse Tyson still hosting the show?
Well, I think it was, it was a trial for all of us because, and certainly for the women who felt uncomfortable. I feel very sorry that it happened, but, you know, there were four investigations. And while, you know, we tried as hard as humanly possible to see, you know, exactly what had happened. We followed the evidence wherever it led, which is the ethos of Cosmos. What we discovered was that, Neil had something to learn about boundaries. There was no ill will behind anything he did. And I've known him his whole adult life, and he's I believe him to be a good person. But I also think that, we're human, we make mistakes, we have personality quirks, and for a lot of people, we've had to develop a learning curve about a newly sensitized world to the rights of women and other people. And that's one of the things that gives me so much hope about the future. If I'm 70 in my lifetime, you know, when I was a young woman coming up, I didn't get to finish a sentence, let alone, you know, I mean, it was all kinds of feelings of being unheard and disrespected. But I've seen a great deal of change in those 70 years, change that makes me feel hopeful, not the complete change, the perfect world, not merely that world yet, but moving in that direction so that people, not extremists, but people, you know, like me, regular people, understand that we have to change the way we act. And I believe that Neil is making every effort to do so, and he gives a remarkable performance in this season. So live and learn.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234, talking about Cosmos. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. There is a line in the original Cosmos series that Dr. Sagan said that has stayed with me for all these decades, and it stayed in the back of my mind. He was talking, it was an episode, it could have been on the evolution of man. He was talking about the brain, and he said, we have a brain, and he paused for a moment, and then he said, think of the possibilities. And I found that so liberating, to think that we can do anything with the power of our brain.
Tom, thank you so much for that call. Anne.
Yes, thank you so much for that memory. And it's very exciting and exhilarating to look back 40 years on our work and to realize how impactful it's been. I really appreciate you telling us. Yes, we have, in fact, an episode in the new season, and I've written a chapter about it in my book, about the brain, about the material reality of dreaming, about the scientist in the 19th century who developed an ingenious machine to actually register the brain's dreaming. And he's one of the many scientists in the series who you've never heard of, but who were so courageous in their work and who contributed so much to our current understanding of nature. So, yes, thank you so much for that comment.
Thanks for that call. And before we go back to our callers, that reminds me, Anne, there is one set of human brain waves, I believe, floating out into the cosmos on Voyager. And those brain waves are yours? How did that come to pass?
They are two sets on each of the Voyagers, one and two, NASA's magnificent Voyagers that completed the first reconnaissance of the outer solar system, launched in 1977, and it was my astonishing honor to be the creative director of the MESSAGE project. And yes, on both of those records are my EEG, my brainwave, my EKG, my heartbeat, and all of the signals that my mind was sending out. They were recorded in hours meditation, and I had a kind of thought itinerary, and they were compressed into sound, and now they have a projected shelf life of 1 to 5 billion years.
Wow.
And they are the most distant objects ever touched by human hands.
We're talking to Anne Drian, co-creator of the original Cosmos series and creator of the newest one. She created the original with the late Carl Sagan. She's got a new book, Cosmos, Possible Worlds. It's the companion to the new series. Back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Fort Atkinson. Scott, hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to say I love the show. I think I read my first Carl Sagan book about space when I was probably like 8 years old. I just had a quick question that, if we are alone in the universe, if we're the only planet with life, what does that say about us? I'm curious to hear your take on that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this very deep question. Well, if we are alone in the cosmos, that just underscores our responsibility to get our act together. Because if we are the only way for the universe to know itself, which I think unlikely, but is certainly possible, then think of the preciousness of the life, the biodiversity of this pale blue dot, this tiny world. If that were the case, then you, everyone listening, you hold in your hands the future of that life and that intelligence. So, you know, to me, that's a wake-up call to say each of us have a responsibility to do what we can to preserve and to cherish that life and our intelligence, a means to know a universe vast and beautiful beyond our reckoning.
Thanks so much for that call. We'll bring on Liz with us now in Ripon. Liz, hello.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about, Liz?
Well, so me and my kids have been watching Cosmos since they were itty-bitty. they're huge Cosmos fans. They're 11 and 6, or 10 and 6. And they're also, they love, we call them Mr. Neil in our house. They were going to have a Mr. Neil birthday party when they were little. Like, they're obsessed. But I was wondering if the new show is going to be as kid-friendly as the other one, if it's something I'll be able to sit down and watch with them.
That's a great question. I mean, I think one of the aspects of the new season is that, you know, feeling that sense of shadow on our future. It seemed to me, looking at popular culture and how dystopian it is, the future that's imagined in virtually every movie or TV show or anywhere is one in which we're all living in shipping containers and everything is ruined. And what I wanted to do was to create a great dream of the future, one that would inspire your children, one that would give them the confidence, you know, necessary to do the hard work to become a scientist or a teacher or an engineer. And so you will see, we will take you to the 2039 New York World's Fair in the near future, and we'll take you to the distant future, to the time when, if we endure, human beings will be living on other worlds that circle other suns. And so, yes, I think it's perfectly great for your children. I think there are 3 episodes that might be disturbing, and I just want to point that out. I can tell you exactly which ones they are. Episode 4, episode 5, and possibly episode 12, although less so. being made with people of all ages in mind. And I hope that, you know, when they see this, they will embrace that hope for the future and that optimism that is not, you know, pie in the sky, but really a world that we can get to.
Liz, thanks for that call. We heard from Pete in Reedsburg, who says the original was one of the most memorable TV experiences of my youth. It may sound silly, Pete writes, but it made me proud to be a human. What do you think of that reaction, Ann?
I love that reaction because we are at a moment, I think, of low human self-esteem. And look at what we've accomplished in a mere 400 years. From Galileo's first look through a telescope to sending our spacecraft to the stars, we are capable of greatness, just as our ancestors were, just as they demonstrated. And now it's our chance to do that. So I'm completely heartened and delighted by that comment. It is, we have a right to feel proud to be human, but now it's time for us to step up.
And thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
I loved the conversation. Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Ann Drian, creator of the Cosmos series from National Geographic and Fox. The new season and the companion book that Ann is the author of are titled Cosmos Possible Worlds. Season 3 of the series premieres next Monday at 7 p.m. Central on the National Geographic Channel. By the way, if you have thoughts growing up with Cosmos, the original series, the newer ones, maybe planning on watching the next one, the influence it might have had on your life or your kids, we'd love to hear those stories. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up after the news, the Supreme Court heard arguments this week about the president's authority over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We'll talk about what different possible outcomes in the case could mean for consumers. You. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is joining a lawsuit against the Trump administration. The suit challenges the president's decision to divert defense funds to pay for a border wall. We'll talk to a state reporter about the impact this could have on Wisconsin. First, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, was in the news this week when the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments around whether its leadership is constitutional. Lawyers representing the White House and the firm Sela Law said the fact that a president can't fire the agency's head over a policy matter is unconstitutional. The counsel defending the current law said the CFPB and other similar agencies require this level of independence to function as designed. Mallory Sorrell is an assistant professor of government and law at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. Her forthcoming book is called Democracy Declined: The Failed Politics of Consumer Financial Protection. Mallory, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, give us a sense of why this bureau, the CFPB, was created in the first place. What is it supposed to be doing?
Sure. So the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was established right after the financial crisis, right? It was part of the big Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act that was passed in 2010. And the goal was to create an agency for the very first time that would be solely responsible for looking out for Americans' financial interests, right? There were a number of other financial regulatory agencies that existed and had existed for a long, long time. But all of those agencies were originally designed to look out for banks. So to look out for the profitability of banks, to make sure that banking was sort of stable. But none of them were really created to look out for consumers' interests. And so when we started passing in Congress consumer financial protection regulations to help consumers, Congress essentially gave oversight for these new laws to these existing financial regulators, none of whom really had expertise in dealing with consumer protection. So one of the consequences of this is that you end up in a situation where consumer financial protection sort of falls through the cracks, right? It's just not as important to a lot of these agencies. And then you end up in a financial crisis. So the goal was to create an agency solely focused on protecting American consumers.
And this came in the lead up to that financial crisis. There was a lot of squirrely behavior by various kinds of financial institutions, in many cases, apparently without the best interests of their consumers at heart. Is that a fair way to state it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think for a lot of people now, it makes sense that if you don't protect consumers, that ultimately leads to some pretty disastrous consequences for the larger financial market. But at the time, that really wasn't the view, right? So sort of engaging in bad behavior often made a lot of money for companies. So as long as these companies looked like they were profiting, people weren't necessarily thinking about the consequences that would come down the road from that.
One decision made by Congress in creating this is part of what has the agency in the Supreme Court today, the idea that we're going to have one director of this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as opposed to a board, but we're going to give some protections for that director from being fired arbitrarily by the president. What went into that decision?
So, you know, that decision, like a lot of things that came with creating the CFPB, was a compromise. I will say consumer advocates, people who supported creating this new agency, were really split about whether they wanted it to have a single director versus a multi-member sort of board. The benefit of a director is that they can sort of act a little more quickly. They can sort of take the agency in a particular direction and make it do the things that consumer advocates wanted them to be able to do. That, of course, depends on having a leader of the agency who supports the mission of the agency, right? It could turn really easily as well. Compared with a board that might be a little bit slower to act, but would also be insulated a little bit more from the turnover from sort of one administration to the next. And so one of the compromises ended up being we will accept a single director that will be able to maybe work a little more quickly, but we're going to embed this agency within the Federal Reserve Board sort of for accountability, right, to an existing agency.
Now, we have this Supreme Court case, a group that was under investigation by the CFPB mm-hmm. challenged the very constitutional existence. The remedy they're looking for is not just for themselves, not just changing the board, but to, in effect, erase everything done, as I understand it, under the Consumer Financial Protection Board.
That's their goal, I think.
Right. And it sounds like the Supreme Court agrees with part of what they want, but not the other part. Watching the Supreme Court, what are you looking for as far as the possible outcomes for this Consumer Financial Protection Agency?
Yeah. So, I mean, at the heart of this debate is something that has absolutely nothing to do with consumer financial protection.
Right.
This is a larger debate about how powerful the president should be, right? And whether or not we should adopt something called a strong unitary executive, which basically means that anyone who is part of the executive branch ultimately should be answerable to and sort of responsible to the president. The idea that the president should be able to do what they want with members of the executive branch. And there's a debate about sort of to what extent the Constitution really intends for the president to have sort of unlimited power over the executive branch or not. And so what's at issue here is this idea that the single director of the CFPB cannot be fired at will, which is to say the president can't just decide to fire the CFPB director simply because the president doesn't like what they're doing. They have to have cause, right? And so the argument before the court is essentially whether the president, whether there should be any position that in the executive branch that the president can't fire at will, or are there some times where we might want to have an executive branch agency that is insulated from the president. In this case, the most sort of drastic outcome would be that the president or that the Supreme Court gets rid of decades and decades of precedent and says that, in fact, they believe in a strong unitary executive and that no agency director, whether a board or an individual, can have any protections against being fired at will. That would also implicate things like the Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Communications Commission. There are a lot of agencies with multiple member boards that have protections against being fired at will. That's very unlikely to happen, right? The court will almost certainly not do that. The next dramatic measure they could take would be to say that the entire CFPB is unconstitutional because they find this directorship unconstitutional, so they're going to get rid of the whole agency. That is, I think, what a lot of opponents of the CFPB would like. It is also, I think, unlikely for a couple of reasons. The first is it would sort of wreak havoc on regulation. What would we do with any of the existing regulations that the CFPB has put forward, many of which are also sort of co-authored by other agencies that would still be in existence? The other reason that's unlikely is that there's a provision in the Dodd-Frank bill that tried to anticipate this scenario and essentially says, look, if the court decides that an individual provision of this bill is unconstitutional, they're instructed to do everything they can to maintain as much of the rest of the law as possible. And even some of the conservative justices on the court, like a Brett Kavanaugh, who seems sympathetic to the idea that the director of the CFPB might be unconstitutional, also seem to feel bound by this mandate to maintain as much of the law as possible. So the most likely outcome is that the sort of five more conservative justices on the court agree that this directorship is unconstitutional, and they will simply strike the language from the law that limits the president's ability to fire the director at will. That would be, you know, that would keep the agency intact. The potential consequence is that you might see a lot of financial companies who have had to pay penalties for violating consumer financial protection laws that the CFPB sort of enforced. They might go to court and say, well, we should get that money back because you just found this structure unconstitutional, and therefore, you know, this penalty should also have been unconstitutional.
We're talking to Mallory Sorrell from Lafayette College, author of the forthcoming book, Democracy Declined, The Failed Politics of Consumer Financial Protection. We're looking at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Mallory, stepping away from the court case, can you give us a sense of what the CFPB has done over the years since its creation? What kind of enforcements have we seen?
Yeah, so it's been a remarkably powerful advocate for consumers, certainly in its first several years when it was under the sort of supervision of an appointee who supported its mission. So, for example, in the first 5 years, they enacted a number of new financial regulations that were supposed to protect consumers from sort of unscrupulous mortgage practices or payday loan practices. They also, through their investigations of companies like Wells Fargo, right, who we know got into some trouble a few years ago with some of their financial practices, they returned just in the first 5 years of operation over $12 billion to about 27 million consumers. It's a huge amount of money that they're putting back in the pockets of consumers. The other thing that they've done that's been very popular among consumers and very unpopular among banks is that they have made their complaint database public. So if you're a consumer and you think your bank is treating you unfairly, they've done something you don't think is right, you can go file a complaint with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You can also look up other consumers who might have filed complaints with the same bank. So it's public, right? You can go and do research on what these banks are doing. But the other great part about this is that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau essentially acts as a mediator. They put you in touch with the bank and try to get those disputes resolved. And they have a very high rate of initiating some sort of resolution process among consumers and banks. And so, again, in the first 5 years of their existence, they handled over 1 million consumer complaints against financial companies. So all of these things are things that the agency is doing to really directly benefit sort of ordinary folks who are having problems with mortgages or credit cards or bank accounts, things like that.
In our last few moments, how did things change under the Trump administration?
So when the original director, Rich Cordray, who was appointed by President Obama, eventually decided to step down, right? He ended up running for governor of Ohio. President Trump was able to sort of name his replacement. First, he put in sort of as a temporary replacement, Mick Mulvaney, right, who we know is now serving as his sort of chief of staff. And then eventually with Kathy Craninger, who was another sort of Trump appointee. Both Mulvaney and to a slightly lesser extent, Craninger, I would say she has not been quite as extreme in her actions as Mulvaney has been. But they went into this position really trying to weaken the power of the agency. So Mulvaney, for example, actually rewrote the mission of the agency to say that they're no longer just serving consumers, but they're actually going to try and serve banks as well. He sort of pushed to roll back some regulations that the agency was about to implement to put limits on things like payday loans. He tried to sort of slow down or potentially weaken some of the enforcement efforts against companies like Equifax, right? If we think, remember the data breach that were, and Wells Fargo actually also, that were taking place. And so, you know, they've done quite a bit to try and, I would say, slow down some of the rulemaking and some of the investigations and enforcement that the agency has been carrying out.
Mallory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Mallory Sorrell, Assistant Professor of Government and Law at Lafayette College. We talked to her today about the Supreme Court arguments this week over the constitutionality of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and its leadership. Coming up, the Trump administration's decision to redirect defense funds to pay for a border wall has some states, including Wisconsin, challenging the move in court. We'll learn more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to an economics professor who argues that to combat climate change, we might need to take a different approach to getting people to take the issue seriously, peer pressure. First, Wisconsin is one of 19 states challenging the Trump administration in court over a decision that would divert nearly $4 billion from the Defense Department to a southern border wall. Governor Tony Evers announced yesterday that he has authorized Attorney General Josh Call to proceed with a legal challenge. In a release, the governor said that the move is a waste of taxpayer dollars and could impact jobs in the state. Our next guest has been following the news and joins us to give us the latest. Riley Vedderkind is a government and politics reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Riley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Lay out the basics here. What is the governor authorizing Attorney General Call to do with this lawsuit?
So the governor has authorized the Attorney General, Democrat Josh Hall, to join a lawsuit with 18 other states, led by California, suing President Trump and the federal government for basically shifting billions of dollars from the military to construct a border wall or to expand the border wall on the border between the U.S. and Mexico. They've taken issue with this because the money, it's around $3.8 billion, $10 billion total, but they're focused on the $3.8 billion here. Some of that money would end up impacting Wisconsin businesses, specifically Oshkosh Corporation or Oshkosh Defense, which is a big producer of military vehicles. And they're saying that because the money is diverting a lot of funds from projects that the National Guard is working on, it would end up diverting around $101 million in funds that the National Guard was set to spend on these heavy expanded mobile tactical trucks, is what they're called, that this company produces. And so Call and Evers are worried that that might end up really affecting jobs in the Oshkosh area and across the state.
And as part of the lawsuit, and that's the harm that Wisconsin and other states are seeing, they're also challenging this on a constitutional basis, right, saying that Congress hadn't authorized the money to be spent this way?
Exactly. Yep. This is kind of a continuation, actually, from another lawsuit. I mean, it is separate, but it kind of uses the same thinking. The plaintiffs in the case are saying that that it really is Congress's responsibility to have control over the purse and to determine what gets spent on which projects. And they're saying that the president is unconstitutionally directing where funds should be spent. And so they do consider consider it an unconstitutional violation of Congress's appropriation power. Josh Call and the governor entered into a lawsuit not too long after taking office back in 2019 along similar grounds, saying that the president's emergency declaration in order to transfer military funds for the border wall was also unconstitutional, that the entire emergency declaration was unconstitutional as well, and that it didn't even constitute an emergency. Obviously, the president's administration pushed back against that thinking, but this is kind of a continuation of what we've been seeing from Democratic legal minds over the past year or so.
Talking to Riley Vedderkin from the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at Wisconsin joining a lawsuit against the federal government over money being diverted from military spending to the border wall. Riley, you talked about the impact on businesses around the country here in Wisconsin in particular. I know the Attorney General of California, who's leading the suit, also said, in effect, National Guard units around the country will be hurt by this because that's what some of these projects would go toward, funding for equipment for National Guard units. Has that been a concern here in Wisconsin?
Yes, actually. I mean, I think the primary concern here is due to the procurement for military vehicles. But the lawsuit also states that the diversion of funds to the border wall threatens around $97 million in military construction projects in funding for military construction projects located in Wisconsin. So that could push back scheduled maintenance and repairs. I mean, this also comes as, I think it was back in September, the Department of Defense had announced that it was at least considering diverting around $8 million from a project at Truax Field here in Madison for a arms range. I don't believe they have reached a final conclusion on whether or not they're going to be withholding that funding, but it certainly had an impact. I think they were also looking at potentially diverting, I think it was around $23 million from the field in near Tomah at Fort McCoy. That was supposed to be very unlikely, and I haven't heard that they've gone forward with that. But you know, a lot of funding at these bases has come under scrutiny from the Defense Department as it looks for ways to fulfill the president's emergency declaration order.
If I'm a group of states and I'm suing the president over something like this, what's the venue? Where does this enter the court system?
This is in federal court. It was led by California, so it has been entered into the district, Northern District for California. There, you know, there is a slight possibility that these lawsuits, including the one that that Josh Call entered into yesterday, and as well as the one that California led and Wisconsin joined last year, could be consolidated, just because judges often take similar issues and try to deal with them in one fell swoop. But, you know, that's just a possibility. But currently this is at district court in California, and, you know, it's probably likely to be appealed, as most of these issues are.
And Riley, what's the timeline for this actually hitting the court?
Well, we'll have to see. I wish I could give a better answer for you, but it's really up to the judge in this case as to how quickly things will move.
Riley, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's Riley Vedderkin, government and politics reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us today to talk about Wisconsin's decision to join a multi-state lawsuit against the Trump administration. That suit challenges the decision by the administration that would divert funds from the defense budget to fund construction of a wall along the U.S. southern border. Wisconsin now part of that lawsuit, as we heard, over concerns in part about jobs and the National Guard here in the state. You can share your reactions and find more over at WPR.org/news. You can also tweet us at Central Time. WPR. The World Championship Cheese Contest is going on right now in Madison, and we are at a critical stage. Central Time producer Dean Kinnetter is a former cheesemonger himself. Hey, Dean.
Hey, Rob.
This is your World Series.
This is big time right now. All of the 132 categories have been judged. They have their winners. And we now have the top 20 cheeses, which have been judged a second time. And one of those will be the world champ.
But we don't call this best in show.
No.
I don't think.
I saw that movie this weekend. It was
really
good.
Okay, it's a fun movie. Now, how is Wisconsin doing so far amongst in the category winners?
The category is pretty darn good. Coming out great in the cheddar categories. A lot of the Havarti's we won. The Colby category, we completely swept all Wisconsin cheesemakers. That's very fitting.
Mm-hmm. And now in the top 20 here, the final 20 that are going for the big prize, how is Wisconsin represented?
We have three cheeses in the top 20. English Hollow Cheddar from Maple Leaf Cheese in Monroe. We've got a Gorgonzola from Roth Cheese made in Seymour. And Marika Penterman's Smoked Cumin Gouda are all in the top 20.
Now, are these viewed as strong contenders? I don't know what Vegas is saying as they make their odds this time around. What do we see here?
If I'm being honest, they're long shots.
They're dark horses.
I will be watching tonight and hoping, pulling for
them.
You're
rooting for them.
But if I'm betting the smart money, something from the Netherlands, Switzerland, they're pretty good at winning this contest.
All right, we'll watch and maybe check in on this tomorrow. Dean, thanks as always for all the latest cheese news.
You bet.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.